Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
On the surface, there isn't much that's frightening about Culver City, California. In the 1970s, it was a place where suburban life and the bright lights of Hollywood came together. Known for its impressive collection of movie studios, it was also home to about 40,000 members of the working class. And when the film opens, we meet single mother Carla Moran, played by Barbara Hershey, who lives in one of Culver City's small bungalows with her three kids, older son Billy, and younger daughters Julie and Kim. Carla is a woman who is at the end of her rope in more ways than one. She's struggling to try and raise her kids on her small salary. She's attending night school, hoping for a better job, and her life is just about to turn into a nightmare like nothing she could have ever imagined. After coming home from her night school secretarial class, Carla is violently raped by some sort of invisible assailant she's, of course, unable to see. The terror of the attack, followed by the destruction of the room she's in, forces Carla to flee with her children to the home of her best friend Cindy, played by Margaret Bly. But this is only a temporary fix. Carla can't afford a motel and can't afford to move, so the family has to go home, but the attack was not a one-time event. The next day, as Carla is on her way to work, she's nearly killed when her car mysteriously goes out of control in traffic. Urged by Cindy to see a doctor, Carla meets with psychiatrist Dr. Phil Snyderman, played by Ron Silver, and tentatively agrees to therapy. But Snyderman doesn't believe in the supernatural. After another attack, which leaves scratches, bruises, and bite marks behind, he believes they're self-inflicted, despite being in places that she could never reach. After Snyderman drives her home that night and meets her family, Carla tells him about the many traumas she's experienced in her life, including being molested as a child, a teen pregnancy, and the violent death of her first husband. As you might imagine, this further convinces him that the rapes she's been reporting are delusions resulting from her past trauma. But almost as soon as he leaves the house, Carla is attacked again, this time in front of her children. Billy tries to intervene, but he's hit by some really phony-looking early 80s special effect electrical discharges that are purple for some reason. Anyway, while the group of medical doctors and psychiatrists in Snyderman's practice who grill Carla in a really uncomfortable scene with a lot of 1980s cigarette smoke all over the room, they believe the events in the house can be dismissed as Carla's delusions, but she insists they're real, which leads them to try and convince her to commit herself to a mental hospital for observation. Yeah, Carla takes a hard pass on that. After her friend Cindy witnesses an attack, the two discuss possible supernatural causes. And when visiting a local bookstore, Carla meets two parapsychologists from UCLA, who she convinces to visit her home. Although skeptical at first, they witnessed several unexplainable events and agreed to return with the head of the department, Dr. Cooley, for a more intense investigation. Meanwhile, Dr. Snyderman is still coming around, trying to convince Carla that everything is in her head and that the parapsychologists have no idea what they're doing. And Carla basically tells him to get lost. Reassured that the things happening to her family are finally being taken seriously, Carla starts to relax and is happy to see her boyfriend, truck driver Jerry Anderson, who has just returned to town. But Jerry is not happy that night when he witnesses Carla being held down on the bed by the entity while being raped and noticeably fondled by invisible fingers. Confused and horrified, he attempts to fight off the attacker. Well, later, after Carla is taken to the hospital, Jerry is so troubled by the incident that he decides to end their relationship. Well, desperate for an end to her abuse, and I'm guessing the filmmakers were desperate for some kind of big bang ending, Carla agrees to take part in an elaborate experiment conducted by Dr. Cooley's team, which involves liquid helium and ice and exploding tanks and all kinds of stuff. Anyway, the entity becomes trapped in the ice, but breaks free and vanishes. The good news is that Dr. Snyderman finally believes that Carla has been telling the truth all along. Well, this is the end, or so it seems, until Carla returns home and the front door of the house slams by itself and she hears a disembodied voice welcoming her home with some choice words that I won't repeat. But she's had enough. She calmly leaves the house, gets in the car with her family, and drives away. Before the credits, a footnote appears on the screen to tell us that Carla and the family moved to Texas. And while she still experiences attacks by the entity, they have lessened in frequency and severity. Well, if only the true story behind the entity was so neatly tied up at the end. It wasn't. And in fact, there isn't much about the real-life story that isn't messy, chaotic, and if true, absolutely terrifying. Unfortunately, there is no solid documentation of what happened in that house in Culver City. The film, like every account of the true story, was based on the 1978 book by Frank DiFolitta called The Entity. When published, the author called it a novelized account of a true haunting. Novelized, the author said, because, quote, no one would believe it was true. And while Frank DiFolitta wrote other horror novels in the 1970s and 80s, notably Audrey Rose, which also became a movie, his book about this case was different. It was different because he was there, in the house, when the events described in the book took place. He witnessed at least some of them firsthand. And while we still have to separate the truth from the fiction in his book, he maintained until his death in 2016 that the events he described in print actually occurred. So watch the film, listen to the story, read the book if you want, and then you can judge for yourself. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most unsettling films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever been shown on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season offers the true story behind these horrifying films, stories that are usually much scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 16 of season 9. The Entity. The true story of the entity doesn't begin with Carla Moran coming home from work one night. It actually started with researchers Barry Taff and Kerry Gaynor from the Department of Parapsychology at UCLA visiting the home on August 22, 1974. A short time earlier, the two men had been discussing the paranormal in a local bookstore when they were approached by a woman named Doris Blither, who wanted to tell them about her haunted house. The pair agreed to meet Doris at her home, not realizing at the time how baffling and terrifying this case would turn out to be. Doris lived in a small, crowded home in Culver City with her six-year-old daughter and her three sons, who were ages 10, 13, and 16. The house was filthy. The family lived in squalor. The terrible living conditions, and I mean, the house had been twice condemned by the city, and the tumultuous relationship between Doris and her sons gave Taff and Gaynor some serious reservations about getting involved. It was later discovered that Doris had suffered abuse from her parents and from several men in her past. Taff and Gaynor began interviewing the family, hoping to understand what was happening. Doris, who was a petite woman in her late 30s, was nervous and unhappy, and it was clear there was tension between her and her three sons. The researchers feared their resentment of Doris might be causing negative feelings in the house, but it quickly became clear that what they claimed was occurring went way beyond just negative feelings. All the family members told the same story, especially when it came to the apparition they'd seen in the house. They described it as semi-solid in form and standing well over 6 feet in height. Both Doris and her older son also claimed to see two other figures who were dark and solid in Doris's bedroom, where the figures seemed to be struggling with one another. This was witnessed several times, and once Doris claimed she physically bumped into one of them in the hallway. The family insisted they had not imagined these apparitions and refused to accept the possibility that they were intruders who had broken into the house. But then the story got worse. Doris claimed that she'd been repeatedly attacked and raped by one of the spirits, while the two smaller beings held her down by her wrists and ankles. This had happened several times, she told them, and after each attack, bite marks and large black bruises were left behind on her legs, arms, breasts, and inner thighs. Doris also dramatically claimed that during one attack, her oldest son had overheard the scuffle and entered her bedroom. She said that he'd witnessed her being tossed back and forth on the bed, and when he tried to help her, an invisible force slammed him into a wall. Her son corroborated the story, saying he was terrified when it happened. Unfortunately, Doris's claim of spectral rape couldn't be verified since it had occurred a few weeks before Taff and Gaynor came to the house. There were no longer any bruises to see, and no adults or anyone outside the family who could verify the events had occurred. They admitted the family seemed shaken and upset, though, but this could easily be explained if Doris was mentally ill or making things up and upsetting the rest of the family with her anxiety. They decided they didn't want to continue pursuing the case. They believed Doris would be better helped by someone in the university's psychology department, not by psychical researchers. However, a few days later, Doris called and informed them that five individuals outside of her family had now seen the apparitions. So Taff and Gaynor decided to return to the house with cameras and tape recorders. They immediately noticed something odd when they entered Doris's bedroom. Even though it was a hot August night and the windows were closed, the temperature was unusually low when comparing the bedroom to the rest of the house. And the cold spots faded in and out, they said, sometimes completely disappearing. They could find no source for the unusual chills, but they soon discovered this was just one of the many oddities in the house. The next of the unexplainable happenings occurred while Gaynor was talking to Doris's oldest son in the kitchen. He was standing a short distance from a lower kitchen cabinet when the cabinet door suddenly swung open and a pan jumped out of it, landing about 3 feet away. After examining the cabinet, Taff and Gaynor went into the bedroom again, with Doris and her friend Candy, who had joined them for the evening and who claimed to be psychic. Taff took a photograph of the bedroom with a Polaroid SX70 camera, and it came out perfectly. After they were in the room for about 15 minutes, though, Candy shouted that she sensed something in the corner. Taff ran back into the room with the camera and immediately aimed it at the corner and took a second photo. This photograph was bleached completely white, as if it had been exposed to some sort of intense energy or radiation. The same thing happened a few minutes later when Candy again directed their attention to the corner. The next photo was still bleached out, but not as badly as the first time. Puzzled, Taff took another photo, this time in the living room, thinking that something might be wrong with the camera, but this photo came out fine, as did the subsequent photos taken by Carrie Gaynor in the bedroom. The only difference was that these photos were not taken while Candy sensed something else was in the room with them. A few minutes later, Taff took another photo, this time because of a cold breeze that came from the closed bedroom door. This one was the strangest of the night, showing an eerie light that was about 1 foot in diameter. In the photo, it was hovering a few inches from the door, but no one had seen the light with the naked eye. While Taff and Gaynor were studying the photo, Taff happened to glance toward the bedroom window and saw several rapidly moving blue balls of light. He immediately raised the Polaroid again and took a photo in the direction of the curtains. The developed image was blurry and bleached out, but there was no sign of the blue lights that Taff had seen. Minutes later, Candy again warned about the presence of the entity in the room, this time standing directly in front of her. Taff fired the Polaroid in her direction, and this resulted in an odd photo of Candy. Her face was completely bleached out, and yet her dress and the room behind her and the room all around her were completely clear and distinct. Another photo, this time taken by Carrie Gaynor under the same conditions, again captured Candy with bleaching all around her face, even though the rest of the photograph was, again, clear. Well, at this point, they became convinced that something out of the ordinary was occurring in the house. Over the course of the next 10 weeks, a team from UCLA was almost always present in the house. They returned many times for investigations, bringing dozens of eyewitnesses, researchers, and photographers with them. Initially, most of the researchers were skeptical of the events reported by Taff and Gaynor, but soon, more of them began to share the belief that something paranormal was happening. That was after they'd witnessed inexplicable events for themselves. One night, what can only be described as a light show took place in the house in front of 20 startled onlookers. Most of the photos that were taken, though, were disappointing. The light was so bright that most of them came out overexposed, although there was nothing logical, natural, or artificial that could be emitting the kind of energy that would wash out a Polaroid photo that way. One of the witnesses present that night was Frank DiFilippo, the author who would go on to write the book based on the case. Frank would later vividly recall the light as it moved into the center of the room and the shouts from those who were present. He said that Doris started screaming as the light moved toward her, cursing and daring the entity to show itself instead of just a light. And at that point, according to Frank and the other witnesses, part of an arm, a neck, and what looked like a bald head began to appear. They all saw it at the same time and swore it was not a hallucination. The investigations continued, and several nights later, Doris made a frantic phone call to the lab and told the researchers that, quote, all hell had broken loose at the house. Items had been broken, furniture overturned, and all the black poster boards that the UCLA team had taped up on the walls to assist with photographing the scene had been torn down. Taff and Gaynor returned to the house that night to survey the damage. They saw the poster boards had been ripped away from the wall with such force that pieces of paint and plaster had been removed along with them. They also noted that the bedroom was frigid compared to the rest of the house and that a foul smell that had been encountered on previous nights had returned. Doris, who claimed she'd also seen apparitions in the house again, refused to be calmed down until nearly midnight. It wasn't until then that Taff and Gaynor felt it was safe enough for them to leave her alone. 5 days later, the UCLA team returned, and once again, they all witnessed the apparition of a large, muscular man in the process of forming in Doris's bedroom. His shoulders, head, and arms were clearly seen by all 20 people who were present. Suddenly, Taff heard a loud thud and turned to see that two members of the team were on the floor. Seeing the apparition proved too much for them to handle, and both had fainted. They both left a short time later and didn't return to the house again. Well, 6 nights later, the rest of the team did return, and the evening started off with Doris recounting incidents that occurred the night before. Both Doris and her 13-year-old son claimed that a pair of candle holders flew across the kitchen and struck Doris on the arm. The boy said they had barely missed him. They also claimed that a large wooden board, which was nailed to the wall under a bedroom window, for reasons I can't begin to guess, was torn loose from the wall and was propelled about 15 feet across the room. The board narrowly missed Doris. She was able to show Taff and Gaynor the bruise left behind by the flying candle holders and that detached board. The team was accompanied that night by Dr. Thelma Moss, head of the laboratory in UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute, as well as several assistants from the lab, a few psychiatrists from the institute who had an interest in the case, and Frank DiFilitta, who had brought along a professional cameraman in hopes of capturing the eerie lights that had been seen in the house on other occasions. The group decided to try a seance, which would hopefully make contact with the entities in the house. They replaced all the black poster boards on the walls before they began, hoping it would make it easier to photograph anything that appeared against the black surface. But the strange lights did not return that night. However, at one point, Gaynor asked the presence in the house to demonstrate its strength by again tearing the poster boards off the walls, but this time in their presence. Almost immediately, several of the poster boards directly above Doris's head were suddenly torn loose, and one of them struck her in the face. The group watched the boards being torn loose from the tape on the walls as if by invisible hands. After quieting and upset Doris, Gaynor again requested the presence remove more poster boards from the walls, and once again, two more well-secured boards were ripped from their position from the back wall and thrown across the bed to the floor. They missed Doris this time, which I'm sure was a relief. The activity reportedly continued over the next few weeks, but the intensity of the events started to decrease. Doris, however, claimed the rapes continued and displayed bruises and scratches on her thighs as evidence. The last visit that Taff and Gaynor made to the house was on October 31st, 1974. It was Halloween, but little out of the ordinary occurred, though. There was only a weak odor and a small sensation of cold, but there were no lights, nothing moved, no apparitions or anything else. The strange happenings at the house eventually stopped altogether, although Doris and her family were gone by then. Subsequent residents of the house never reported anything out of the ordinary, and the house has since been restored and is in good condition today. As for Doris, Taff and Gaynor temporarily lost contact with her and the children. Then 3 months later, in February 1975, they discovered she'd fled Culver City for Carson, California. Then she'd moved to San Bernardino, to Texas, and then back to San Bernardino again. According to her claims, the spirits followed her and her family to every house to which they moved. And over time, she became more unstable. And she later reported that she'd become pregnant by the ghost. A medical test revealed her physical symptoms to be the result of what's called a hysterical pregnancy. It was no surprise, given the circumstances, that Doris believed the entity would eventually kill her. Well, after that, Doris dropped out of sight, and it was later learned that she passed away in the late 1990s. Her children have never come forward to speak about the case. Thanks in part to the fact that the alleged supernatural events seemed to follow Doris wherever she went, Barry Taff eventually came to believe that the strange events were the product of Doris's troubled mind. She had a history with alcohol and drug addiction, had suffered from a traumatic childhood, and had been involved in several abusive relationships as an adult. Some have suggested that the three entities that held her down and raped her were manifestations created in her subconscious to represent her three sons, with whom she had a troubled relationship. Taff suggested that everything that had occurred could be explained as a poltergeist outbreak, energy created by Doris's anxiety and tension. Her pain and mental anguish had, in a very real sense, created the monster that preyed upon her. Years after his involvement with this story, though, I had the chance to speak with Dr. Taff about it, and he told me he still had some nagging doubts about his belief that Doris had created everything he and the rest of the team had witnessed and experienced. What if we were wrong? He asked. What if there really are discarnate entities that prey on weak and emotionally troubled individuals? What if ancient mythology regarding the incubus and the succubus are more than just legend, superstition, and religious hysteria? Are we so cock-fired sure of ourselves and our neonatal paranormal science that such a definitive statement is possible? I don't know. Maybe he's right. I mean, what really happened in that house in Culver City? No one can say. According to science, there was something occurring in that house. The UCLA team was able to document it with recordings, photographs, and even readings from Geiger counters. But whether that something was supernatural or created by the troubled parts of Doris Blither's mind, well, that remains a mystery. The filming of the entity took place over a 10-week period in Los Angeles and El Segundo, California, in the spring of 1980. Despite being completed and set for release in 1981, the film went unreleased until the fall of 1982, when it was acquired by 20th Century Fox and finally released in England. No one wanted to touch it here, at least at first. Finally, the studio dumped it into the dead weeks after Christmas, and it hit U.S. theaters in February of 1983. And not everyone was happy about that. The film seemed to have a way of offending everyone with its themes of rape, violence, sexual repression, single-parent households, and, of course, the supernatural. Churches, women's rights, and feminist organizations protested against it, even attacking star Barbara Hershey for appearing in the film at all. In response to the protest, she publicly responded, telling a reporter, quote, "I resent being put in the position of defending the film. We worked really hard not to make it exploitative. Rape is one of the ugliest, if not the ugliest thing that can happen to someone. It's a murder of a sort. I have no answer for those who are offended." Hershey hadn't even been the original choice to play Carla. Several other actresses were approached first, including Jill Clayburgh, Sally Field, Jane Fonda, and Bette Midler, but all four turned it down. Barbara Hershey was cast only 10 days before production began, and she had hesitated before signing on. She'd had some reservations about the nudity in the screenplay. But director Sidney Furie assured her that the nude sequences would be accomplished using body doubles, like when Carla's getting into the bathtub, and by mannequins and special effects, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Hershey commented on her casting, saying, quote, "I was frightened. I didn't know how it would be edited or marketed, but I knew Sid saw potential in the film to approach the subject from a human and psychiatric viewpoint, from a mother's viewpoint, and I felt it was a worthwhile risk." As for director Sidney Furie, he told journalists in 2012 that he did not consider The Entity to be a horror film, despite its extreme imagery, unsettling atmosphere, and horror plot. Instead, he said he'd consider it to be a supernatural suspense movie. Okay, isn't that a horror film? Anyway, if you wondered about any of the special effects in the film, they were all practical effects that were supervised by Stan Winston, who was known for creating The Terminator and The Predator and worked on Aliens, the first three Jurassic Park films, and The Thing, among others. He won 4 Academy Awards for his work. He did not, however, win an Oscar for this one. Although, honestly, aside from the really bad 80s digital effects that looked like they were rejected from Tron, it's pretty impressive for the time. I mean, for example, in the scene where Carla's nude body is groped by the entity, it was shot using a latex dummy with suction cups inside. This allowed crew members to manipulate it, as so it would appear that fingers were making impressions on her flesh. Hershey's body, except for her head, was hidden beneath the bed. The dummy apparently cost $65,000 to build. In 1981 dollars. Well, I guess it looks realistic as long as you don't look too closely. Like I often say, not every movie needs to be in ultra high definition 4K. This is one of them. Anyway, the critical response to the film was overall pretty good. Roger Ebert liked it, and many reviewers praised Frank DiFilippo for turning his novel into an effective film. Director Martin Scorsese has ranked The Entity as the 4th scariest horror film of all time, ranking it above Psycho and The Shining. I mean, it's not bad, but I don't think I'd go that far. In the end, The Entity remains a worthwhile addition to the library of any horror fan. It's a nice time capsule of the early 1980s and is a film that, no matter how horrific and frightening it might be, allows us to separate ourselves from the sadness, pain, and tragedy of the all-too-real family that inspired it. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay with us for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Come here.
20th Century Fox presents the story of Carla Moran. The most extraordinary case in the history of psychic research.
Everything broke loose. It went crazy. And everything was shaking. The bed was shaking. And the walls were shaking. And
like an earthquake.
No, it wasn't like an earthquake. It was much stronger than any earthquake. Oh, wait a minute. Honey, I don't really understand this. You were attacked?
Come here, come here.
Or you weren't?
It happened. I was raped.
You were raped by whom?
I don't know. There was no one there.
A team of experts will investigate her life.
Why does he attack you, Carla? Not anyone else.
Why is she going to such lengths to support this delusion?
And they will find more than evidence. They will find the entity.
We don't need to do it again later. So let's just hopefully it'll work. So,
all right. I am ready when you are.
Okay. Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we are back with the postmortem. The part of the show after the show where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who just told me he's pretty sure that someone got into his bed last night, but when he turned on the light, there was nobody there. That's my friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host,
Cody Beck.
They didn't even let me be Little Spoon. You know,
whoever it was, right?
Whoever it right? was. So it's a selfish ghost at that.
Yeah, sounds like it, man.
Yeah. This we're going to talk about it, but yeah, this was a rough one, man.
Well, it's a hard one to make jokes. Yes. I had to kind of confine my jokes to the special effects.
Yes.
For the most part, other than a couple of really obvious things, but still, it is not. And unfortunately, we're this isn't, we're going to have more of these still come.
I'm really mad at you. So thank you for
I know,
that.
I know. So, well, yeah. And then coming after the last episode, which also had some problems. Anyway, that's what happens when you pick old movies. So anyway, that's the way it goes. All right. Well, we've got some stuff coming up. We know it's not fall, but it's time to start thinking about fall. Our tickets are now on sale for tours in Decatur, Springfield, and Alton, where we have, in Alton, walking tours, bus tours, pub crawls, dinner tours, dinner events, the American Oddities Museum, the Houdini Seance on Halloween, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So you could find everything that we offer at AmericanHauntings.net. That'll get you anywhere you want to go, whether it's books or tours or dinners or whatever. And that even includes my new book. My new Route 66 book is out now. That's my Texas, New Mexico, Arizona book. You can get signed copies by mail or when I'm at the museum, which is not that often normally, but on August 23rd, we'll have a book signing. We have a book signing scheduled from 12 to 3 p.m. that day. So I will be there on the 23rd. So come by if you've got, want to pick up one of the new books, look at some of the recent releases. You got any old books you need to bring that aren't signed? I'll sign those too. I'll sign just about anything, honestly. So,
babies.
Well, I mean, if you want me to sign your baby, I can, I guess. I don't know why anybody would want me to, but and I didn't know you had a baby, but guess I will. Okay. But we'll also first 50 people that show up that day. We got a limited edition American Oddities Museum button just for fun. So
nice.
Yeah. Give those away for free. So
that's awesome. People. Awesome.
They'll be there till they run out. So.
Beautiful. Anyway, well, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our new subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Stephanie, Jennifer, Gabby, Christy, Andrea, and Jane. So thank you very much for supporting the show. And I'm also sorry for the Patreon season you're going through right now.
The season that people are dealing with. The good news is that next week will be the season finale of our Monster season 5. That way, if you've been waiting for that season to be over and you want to binge the whole thing because you hate yourself, this would be the time to do it after next week, because we'll be putting that up next Tuesday, because we do it every other week. So it doesn't fall the same week as this, not normally anyway, except for that Bell Witch bonus episode that we did. We usually don't have Patreon shows and a regular show at the same time, but sometimes we do. But anyway, you could check it out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Beautiful. And I have a listener review that I wanted to read real quick. And this one comes to us from Angel Millett on iTunes. And it's titled My New Favorite Podcast. It says, I'm so thankful that I was able to meet Troy last weekend. I'm so glad.
Oh, is it ours? Our podcast is
Our podcast.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, okay. Oh, cool.
I know. I'm sorry.
I shouldn't have
blindsided you with that.
Yeah, I'm just surprised. So,
it says, anyway, I'm so glad that he came down to be a part of our Phantom Funeral event.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was fun.
Okay. I bought several books of his, then discovered his podcast, and I'm hooked. All of my favorite things in one: history, paranormal, and crime. It's definitely worth a listen. So thank you very much for that review.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And if we do read your review, not just your random text, everybody calm your jets. Mm-hmm. If we read your review. And you send us your address, we'll send you something cool in the mail. You can text us on the haunt line with that address at 217-791-7859. Not just random texts just for reviews. So that's your incentive to leave reviews. Not that we don't like getting your texts, because we have some good ones this time, but we do like getting them, but that is, free stuff.
Yeah.
Equals reviews.
And yeah, and this is our way of saying, we appreciate the reviews. And yes, we are bribing you, if you like the show, to leave good reviews. And I don't care.
So why not?
Yeah. Get free stuff.
That's the way it goes. That's right.
You want to dive into this episode?
Sure.
So August 22nd, 1974, my birthday, not yet, but
well, before. Yeah, I would say in a few more years. Yeah.
Yes. But August 22nd. I was surprised to see, I guess, the story that you told, and then watching the film, it's a movie, but not as many liberties taken with it, like as far as the story goes.
Not a ton. I mean, one of the things I don't think it really covered much in the film, and maybe, I mean, for obvious reasons I can point out as far as budgets and things go, but there were like 20, 25 people in that house all the time during the real life investigations. In the film, you just have the two guys that are, posing or taking the place of Barry Taff and Cary Gaynor. So you really only have the two doctors there. You don't really have the crowd that they had. But yeah, but still, like you said, not as many liberties as you might expect. So
yeah. So something also that I found interesting.
For the kids. The kid.
Well,
situation completely different.
It was. I mean, it definitely reminded me of, growing up with a single mother and being wanting to like fight everyone and anything. But like,
sure.
I was actually a tiny person. And then I guess in the real story, it was also a younger. Son. But
kids were a little. Yeah. Well, three sons and one daughter instead of an older son and two daughters.
Right.
So I don't know I'm not sure what the thinking or the reasoning for that with the film. I don't know, but here we are.
Exactly. So. Well, something that interested me about the story is at one point, one of the children, I believe, said that they saw two figures that seemed to be struggling with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I never really even thought about. Like, do ghosts have quarrels and fights and qualms and things,
apparently those do. Of course, they rapist helper ghosts apparently
quarrel. Yes.
And look at it this way, this is some really violent stuff, so
I hate it.
Maybe that has something to do with the struggling between the ghosts. I don't know, maybe the I don't know. This is one of those stories that really leaves a lot to you wondering what in the hell is going on here. It really does. I think that if I had to give you my nutshell, thought on, I think that, I had talked to Barry Taff years.
Yes. Later, yes.
And about 30 years later, as a matter of fact, and, he had, had kind of come back by that time. He was thinking, well, maybe there was more to this than I originally thought, but he kind of walked away from the whole thing with this was something that was created by Doris. This was something, and it kind of spread like a contagion to her kids, as hysteria and that kind of thing can do. But they did see a lot of stuff going on in the house. They photographed it, they measured it, they documented a lot of weird happenings. So I don't know, I guess you could go either way on this. I mean, I could kind of agree with them on it being something that Doris conjured up, but boy, on the other hand, this is some really severe stuff. Sure. I mean, this is not your normal kind of haunting here.
So, yeah. Obviously. And I think a lot of poltergeist and things like that, we typically see younger girls, I'd say, instead of women.
But not always. The Enfield poltergeist case is a good example of that, because that was, when we talked about that you know, and I hate to bring up the Warrens again, but we were talking about The Conjuring Part Two. No, I'm not going to talk about the Warrens, just the movie. When we were talking about that movie and the real story with Guy Playfair and Morris Gross, Morris not so much, but Guy Playfair really believed that it was the mother who was creating a lot of that activity, more so even than the girls, because of her traumas and the divorce and the abuse and all of that kind of stuff. So, I mean, this woman really, she'd been through it, molested as a kid, had all these different partners who, had teen pregnancy, had partners who were, treated her horribly, more abusive. And, obviously she was kind of coming apart herself. I mean, when she starts talking about how the ghost got her pregnant and stuff, I think that her mental health was, I think in this case that she could have benefited from both these researchers who were coming in, looking at this as some kind of, poltergeist activity, or at least some sort of attack. But I also think she really could have benefited from an actual psychiatrist, unlike in the movie where you got, Ron Silver, who inevitably played scuzzy, sleazy characters. This is one of the few movies where he's sort of the good guy, but yet, because we're seeing all these things happening, we know it's real and he refuses to admit it until the very end. Mm-hmm. Right. So he's kind of portrayed as the bad guy because he just keeps coming around and harassing her, So I don't know. It's a movie. The movie version is different than real life. So
the music in this movie, like anytime anything scary is about to happen, you just hear like bam, 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 bam,
yeah,
bam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is really kind of consider when this movie came out, kind of a predecessor to just about every Blumhouse movie that's come out in the last 10, 15 years, because, that's one of the big criticisms they get is, telegraphing any kind of, scary activity with music. And mm-hmm. This is definitely doing that.
Yes.
This movie. Yeah.
In an aggressive way.
Very aggressive.
The only other thing I wanted to talk about with this movie is I know that these were mostly like psychiatrists and things like that, but when they're all in a meeting and they actually have the woman with her and then she leaves. But I love that they're just cigars and cigarettes.
Oh, I did too. I said abundance. That out loud. I'm watching this by myself and I'm watching this movie and it as she leaves the room and there's just a cloud. And I went, boy, that's the early 1980s. Yep. Oh man.
This whole movie is so 80s.
It's like this smoking section in restaurants back then or on planes. Mm-hmm. There was no division. Just here's where it stops. Here's where the non-smoking starts. So if you're sitting anywhere near it, you're in a cloud.
Oh, 100%.
And so, yeah. And so that's what this reminded me of. It was very funny.
Oh my gosh. Well, we've talked about it a lot and there's a lot I don't even want to go into. This is a rough watch. Just a
it is.
Trigger warning for people.
It is. It should be a trigger warning for people. But here's the other thing.
You can't find it.
You're going to have a hard time finding it because we discovered that coming into this movie, it was already planned on our list because, I mean, and when you mention it to people, they go, oh, yeah, I remember that one. But most people like me hadn't seen it in years because it's not streaming anywhere.
Yeah.
And so I had to track down. I did find a Blu-ray that came out a few years ago, but I'm guessing it came out because it's not streaming anywhere. But I did track down a Blu-ray on eBay. Mm-hmm. I had to get that. And then I had to give it to Cody so he could watch it too, because we had no options here with this film. It was a tough one to find, but it was interesting to see a lot of the things that people had to say, even that were involved in it, mm-hmm. Like the director saying that
people were not happy.
No. And the director saying it was a supernatural suspense movie.
Right.
But dude, isn't that a horror film?
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, it was that they interviewed him in 2012. That's when he said that. And that was right around that time when nobody was making horror films because it was kind of on the outs at the time. And so it was like everybody was using everything they could to say it wasn't a horror film, even though it obviously was.
You 100%.
Know, this was the beginning of the elevated horror genre, you know, of everybody. Oh, it's yes, it's a horror film, but it's also art. Oh, come on, man.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Let's roll with that. That'll work. So, but yeah. And then, you know, I was trying to plead the case for Stan Winston, you know, in this. I'm just going to say he supervised it rather than actually created it.
Because, there you go.
I mean, let's just not even talk about the lightning bolts that are coming, the purple lightning coming off every
Star Wars
so bad. That. Yeah, that is what it looks like. Yeah, it does. But I mean, even that, I mean, I know Barbara Hershey was like, oh, you know, I don't want to do all this nudity, and she didn't have to. But honestly, I wouldn't. I mean, I'm separating this completely from the whole rape part of it.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay, sure.
This is a technical observation. Okay. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want people to think that's what I look like naked.
Ah,
that dummy.
Okay. Yes.
Do you see what I mean?
Because $65,000 dummy.
Yes, the $65,000 dummy, because it's not appealing. And I mean, it looks rough. And I think it's because the chest and the neck on it comes up so high because her head is underneath the bed poking through the bottom that it really looks unrealistic.
Didn't you say that like there were suction cups involved
inside? Yeah, inside. So okay. It looks like the fingers. Now that worked.
Yeah.
I mean, it did look like, you know, it looked like fingers, but it looked like fingers in Play-Doh.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking 65 grand for Play-Doh, essentially
that,
what it looked like. That's rough. And again, it was one of the things I said is, you know, and we talked about this before, not everything needs to be ultra high def 4K.
Exactly.
I don't think this film needed it. They get older and they're shot with, you know, on film cameras, sometimes that high def doesn't do anyone favors.
That is very true.
It's like when
I
want to
see your
using,
pores. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, that's when they started using 4K for television news programs, and everybody that was a newscaster were just freaked out because you could see everyone's pores. So at first they had on like a, you know, 2 inches of makeup, which looked awful because you could see that too. So yeah. Anyway, it's not a, I don't know. It is definitely a time capsule of the 80s. That was one of the kinder things that I can think of. And
it is very
to say, and it's, you know, but it's an effective film. Let's put it that way. I mean, it does what it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the you know, the ending with the gigantic, we're going to rebuild your house inside this huge, I don't know, gymnasium or something at UCLA. Come on, man.
Yeah.
There's no way they had time to do that.
No.
And where did they get all that? Where did they get all that liquid helium or whatever it was that they were trying to freeze the ghost with? And why, when people ran in there to grab her and and Carla, why didn't they freeze? Because if it's that cold, it should have killed them.
I still could. Yeah, I didn't understand the
a lot of holes there.
I didn't understand the rules, I guess, of the universe exactly and how that
either.
Either. yeah, but I mean, when you said the film's effective, it made me upset a lot of times. Yeah,
it does. And, you know, I can see in 1981 where people, you know, if you heard about this movie without seeing it,
mm-hmm.
and you heard what it was about, it sounds like bad Penthouse Forum letter.
Yes.
Kind of stuff.
Yes.
And so I'm sure that because I doubt anyone who protested it had even seen it yet, because that's normally the way that seems to work. And so I'm sure that was probably I think that was Barbara Hershey's exasperation and frustration with it. Why I shouldn't have to defend this. If you had seen it, you would understand what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not glorifying rape. That's for damn sure. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that
What'd she say? She's like, I'm doing it to show that like rape's like the ugliest thing.
Well, and that, she said it is the ugliest thing. And she was trying to, her thought was trying to show this from the viewpoint of the single mother and what was happening to her and how horrible it was. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have watched this film over time for the, you know, the titillation factor. But there really isn't any of that. You don't get that from this at all. There isn't anything about it that you know, the nudity in it is, well, for one thing, it's not her.
Right.
And there's really only one woman who has a very brief nude scene, and that's a body double getting into the bathtub. The rest of the time, you don't really see much of anything except for that, you know, dummy. And if you think that's real, if you for even in 1981 looked at that and thought that was a real body, you should get out of the house.
Yeah, you got problems.
Yeah, that's anyway. So
So I hadn't read any of your outline before I started watching the movie, and so the first time she's attacked, I was like, wait a second, was that an assault, like what I think happened? And then, you know, kept watching the movie. I was like, oh, okay. And also the doctor in the beginning, it just seemed a little creepy to me, the like way he talked to her and all that.
I know,
you
know? That's kind of what I thought too, but yeah, you know, it was maybe I don't know.
He wasn't a bad guy, but I was like, this seems weird. And then like when she's showing bruises and things like that, and eventually there was a woman that he said, hey, you know, can you leave the room, and so they could start talking. But I'm like, have a woman, somebody she's more comfortable with, check her out. You know,
you're like, kidding, right?
It's an interesting movie. You pretty much got a lot of what we talked about, but hey, if you watch it, it's on you. If you can find it, because you're gonna have to go out of your way to find it,
like you are so. And I, you know, I think that as far as the real story goes, the real story is much more, I mean, even more tragic than what you see in the film. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
It's bad enough. The film is bad enough, but the real life story is just really sad. I mean, you know, I think that she had a lot going on. She had a lot of problems. It had nothing really to do with ghosts and things, but you know, there was the activity there and they did document it, but
yes.
I don't know, man. It's wild. It's a pretty wild story.
And I've brought this up before, but I don't think that you had told me this much, but with your conversation with Dr. Taff and how I'd said how I had a friend who one time was like, I was like, are you guys like actually seeing ghosts, or are you just, you know, messed up? And he's like, if you're messed up, wouldn't that be the perfect time for ghosts to like, or, you know, something?
Well,
to,
they're good point.
You know, attack you.
Yeah, so point.
Can you tell me a little bit about your actual conversation with Dr. Taff?
Well, I had posted something about the real life story, and he had contacted me through email. And this was early 2000. So pretty, you know, early on.
Where'd you post it?
Website, because back then there weren't that many ghost websites.
OK.
Much lower number than there would be later. And anyway, he had contacted me, and then we got to talking, and he actually sent me, he had written a manuscript about this case and some other stuff too, a lot of alien type stuff where he'd gotten kind of interested in, which I had no interest in, but had sent me the manuscript, and which I've referenced in a few different places when I've talked about this story. I always reference that manuscript because it had some stuff in it that wasn't just widely known, you know, at the time. And, you know, he just had mentioned that, you know, some of the things that they had seen and things. And, you know, I kind of worked all that into the story best I could. But that's, you know, where the quote came from about, you know, him talking about, hey, maybe we're wrong about this. You know, maybe there is something. Maybe that's how all these legends of these, you know, succubus and the incubi, and that's how that got started. You know, maybe it's real. But I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I don't know what to think about it. I kind of think that they were on the right track. And, you know, in the first place, that maybe, you know, this was something that she was creating, you know, and we've run across that time and time and time again, you know, even just in this season, we've had several episodes that's kind of how it ends up. And, I don't know. I think that when you see the way that her mental health deteriorated after she just drops out of sight and moves all over the place, and the fact that her kids have never really come forward to talk about it themselves and tell their side of the story, it's kind of like they just want this thing to be done and right. over with, and no, it never will be. But the good thing is that no one knows their names. So they're
good,
pretty well protected. You know, it was, it was a long time before anybody even knew what her name was, because I've run across several different names that were used for pseudonyms over time. And, but Doris Blither is her real name. But you know, I think the kids have just sort of moved on, and that probably says a lot too. You know, don't you think? Yeah. If it had been ghosts and stuff, really, and if they were sure about that, they probably would have come to her defense at some point after the hysterical pregnancy stuff and everything. So I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't think we're ever going to know, really. not in this one. But the stuff that they have documented is interesting stuff. I've seen the photographs they took with the Polaroids and the things with the lights and stuff, and they're available out there. But they're impressive looking. I mean, there's something in them, knowing that they were using Polaroids. So it wasn't like the film was getting, tampered with or distorted in some way, that was really happening. And there were 20 and 25 people there all the time. That's pretty impressive,
Yeah.
So something was going on, whether or not it was a rapist ghost, I have no idea, but
yeah.
So, it's interesting.
It's very interesting. So say that it was her, and projecting the stuff and all that. Do you think that I'm trying to figure out the way to phrase this? It's like, is it because she has mental illness that her mind's going nuts and this is projecting out, or is it that it's projecting out and that's causing a mental illness, or is it a yes to both, or I mean?
That's a good question. And I think that you could look at that either way, honestly. I really do. It could have gone either way. It could go either way with anytime you run across a situation like that, when you hear that kind of thing. I think it could go. I really do. I think it could go either way.
Yeah. I mean, my depression and anxiety is bad, but damn, I'm not manifesting
stuff. That's good. So
gosh, that other people can interact with and things gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. We could talk about this for hours. I don't want to. I don't have any ghostwriter stuff, but you want to move on to some hotline stuff?
Yeah, we do have things for the hotline. So if you do have questions or comments about the show, if it's longer than just something quick that you'd text, you can send it to Cody via email at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com, or you can text us on the hotline. And that number is 217-791-7859. And it might get read on the show, like the ones that I'm just about to read to you.
Let's
go. They're all about, for the most part, I think, about past shows. This is probably going to be our last Jaws text because that was an episode that just keeps on giving, though, because everybody likes that movie, I think. So
Brucey.
So this one comes to us from the 920 area code. And it says, the year Jaws came out, I think I was about 12. My dad bought us a little sailboat, just room for two people. And we went to Rocky, Connecticut. I sail around for a while. The water's very calm. I pulled in the sail and laid down to read a book with my head propped up on the boat next to the tiller, my hair spilling out over the side into the water. I'm happily reading when I suddenly jerk my head up, looking fearfully over the sides of the boat, wondering, didn't they film Jaws here? I raised the sail and beat it back to shore. So that's a funny one. I like that. That was good. So, all right. So let's see this one. Okay. So this is sort of a little bit on Jaws, only just a bit. This one comes from Andra in the 770 area code. And we've read text from her before, but this one's funny. It says, this test is super short. Love the Jaws episode a couple of weeks ago. You mentioned the composer John Williams. I think he and Jerry Goldsmith were both incredible. And I agree with that. Good soundtracks. Do you know that John Williams' son was/is the lead singer of Toto?
No shit.
I did not know that. Yeah. So how crazy is that? Music runs in the family for sure. Thanks for the great podcast. So I just want to read that because I thought that was pretty cool. So, all right. So this one, we're gonna have to deal with a couple of, we're not, I don't say that in a bad way. We're going to deal with some of our discussions about Jeepers Creepers and how to handle that art and artist thing. So we did have some people chime in.
Yes.
One is Bryce from the Tucson area. Even though, as he mentions, his area code is actually from Phoenix, but it's okay. This is New Mexico. Arizona. Jesus, I'm really losing.
Get it together.
I know, right? All right, so just listen to your episode on Jeepers Creepers. It's a film I never got around to watching when it first came out. By the time I would have been able to sit and stream it, I already knew about the director. Like you, sometimes I can separate the art from the artist. Sometimes I can't. I find it's a lot easier for me if you consider the time of history in which someone lived. A racist actor or athlete from the 1930s isn't all that big of a deal to me because that's just how things were at the time, unfortunately. Same goes with other less than ideal or downright disgusting aspects of history and the people who made it. However, when it comes to child grooming and pedophilia, there really is no period of modern history where that was just something no society was broadly okay with. This guy is just a monster to me, not a product of his time. So while I'm not sure I can bring myself to watch Jeepers Creepers, the story that inspired it is worth telling. So it was a great episode all the same. So, yeah,
I agree. I agree with that. And if I hadn't seen Jeepers Creepers yet, I would just be like, I ain't watching that shit. Like,
I know.
I know, I get it. I get it. OK, I get it.
All right. So this one comes to us from the 618. And it is another one along that line and has some good points to make here. So just listen to the Jeepers Creepers episode. The question of how do we deal with artists when we find out they're horrible people? I don't know. I grew up with Bill Cosby. I raced home from kindergarten to get my picture pages out to color with Bill Cosby on Captain Kangaroo and the Fat Albert and the Cosby Show and listened to my dad's LPs of his stand-up later on. To find out he was awful doesn't make his work less good. Same with O.J. Simpson. He was the juice, a childhood hero. How do you separate that? No idea. I still don't know. You can't erase the work they've done or the records they've set or the jokes they told, but you hate to keep supporting their living. Well, with OJ, you're in good luck because he's dead. So, you know, but then you think about, you know, how funny was the dude in those, you know, police when the, in the, you know, the movies he did. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Naked Gun.
Yeah. I mean, he was really funny in those. And you got to separate it from that, you know, but whoever would have thought when it happened
that he might separate a head or two. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. So this goes on. Jerry Lee Lewis basically groomed and married his cousin. It's disgusting to think about. Do I still sing along to his songs? Of course. He's a musical genius. I would argue the musical genius part, but whatever. I understand what you're saying. So it's hard to reconcile. And this goes on. It's hard to reconcile this stuff in your mind. It is one of those things. It's hard to know how do you separate that stuff. It's a good question. It's one that we're still asking.
Can I bring something up? I think we've talked about this before, but like it's way easier when you don't like the artist content to be like, no,
exactly.
Fuck that person.
I'm not going to listen to it anyway. Yeah. I never thought Louis C.K. was all that funny anyway.
Yes.
But on the other hand, at least he asked permission before he did the stuff he did. But
that's still
gross.
But
it's like, you know, I didn't think you were funny anyway. So the fact that no one's watching you now, I wasn't going to watch you anyway because I never thought you were funny.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know it does kind of fall into that thing where it is a lot easier.
You only wrestle with it if you like their content. Yeah,
that's true. That's a good point. So, all right. So here's one coming back to our Bellwitch Cave episode. And this is from the 518. Hey there, have a question. After listening to the episode about the Bellwitch Cave, I was wondering if you believe in an attachment, as in when an entity attaches to you after visiting a haunted place. Have you ever experienced this after visiting the cave, or have you experienced unusual things at home after visiting the cave? No, because I don't take rocks with me from the cave. I know what you're saying as far as attachments go. I think in this kind of case, I'm not sure that it's individual ghosts. ghosts that are following people home and giving them bad luck. I think it's the energy at the place. And I think you're taking a bit of that energy with you. And that's maybe what's creating the bad luck, or you're creating it yourself. Also, based on that energy that you're taking with you. So I think that, you know, I guess it really depends on what you believe in. I don't think individual ghosts are following people home. I don't think it's the Bell Witch who's, you know, going to people's houses and, you know, and wreaking havoc and causing them to catch on fire and that kind of thing, or, you know, causing, you know, someone's face to, you know, swell up or whatever, you know. I really think that it's energy that's attached to the place. So I guess in a way it's an attachment. It's just that it's energy, not necessarily a ghost. That's just my opinion. So.
I'd be very curious with Bell Witch stuff. People might write in or whatever, but I can't take anything seriously that they're going to say, but I'd be very curious if anyone was very nice, very respectful, didn't take a rock and felt anything, or is it like the guilt of I did something I wasn't supposed to do or disrespect?
I don't know. You know, that's a good thought too. Yeah, that's what I said. Sometimes I think maybe if we create our own bad luck, maybe part of that is from the guilt we feel, or because someone, you know, like me has warned them, do not take a rock. And they take one anyway. And then they think, oh, look, I got away with this rock. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going to happen to me. And then something does.
Yeah.
And so then you blow that up even bigger in your mind because now you've done something forbidden. So mm-hmm.
it could be different ways
to look at that.
It could have been your voice in the back of their head that then pushed everything. No, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, this is our last one. It comes from Karen in Maryland. And, Troy and Cody became a patron a couple weeks ago and am loving the extra content. Finished the Belgunis storyline and itching to know even more about the woman. But here's her question. I'm curious, since this season is based on a true story, is there a story you and Cody would like to see made into a movie?
Oh, just like a story in general?
Just a real life story that we'd like to see made into a movie. Maybe it's something that has been made before, but maybe we don't feel like it was all that great, or, you know, et cetera. You know, I think there have been some things that have been done, you know, that, you know, could be better. I'd love to see a much better Houdini film than anything we've ever seen. I would love to see an Al Capone film that is not The Untouchables, which, you know, because that's really an Elliot Ness movie. And, you know how I feel about the history. I love that movie. But man, the history's so bad. But, you know, I would like to see at least semi-accurate Capone movie that would be better than the crap that has been put out before. You know, say Valentine's Day Massacre, even. I mean, there was one back in the 70s, but it's unwatchable, you know. So, yeah, there's some other stuff, too. We were talking about something. I thought you and I were talking about something recently that I can't understand why a film hasn't been made of it.
Thing I was making the jokes about Timothée Chalamet playing somebody, maybe was our.
It might have been. I don't know. But yeah, there are. I should have really given this more thought before I just threw it out there.
No,
so. Because it's kind of, I've put you on the spot. I should have warned you ahead of time. But, you know, I'd have to think about it some more, I think. Maybe I'll make a reminder to think about that a little bit.
Yeah.
And, we might actually say something about it next time.
I think actually you and I should probably talk about that and then make it a little tiny segment next time, like a mini.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. We'll get back to you on that, Karen. And we'll figure out. We'll come up with a short list of some things, because I know there are some other ones, because I was just talking about something and I cannot remember what it was. And I said, I don't understand why. Oh, I know what it was.
What's that?
I know what it was. Now I'm not going to say it.
Oh, you're going to hold it.
So,
well, that's also something
I'm going to put it on the list.
Something, Troy, that I heard the other day, where somebody was like, okay, Hollywood, you know, remakes these movies or takes animated versions and makes, you know, real life and all that. It's like, why don't we, and I get why they do that. Don't get me wrong. Cause people say they want new stuff, but then they go
keep remaking stuff. When there's so many things there that could be made that they're not making,
but
so,
they also people pay to see the remake of Aladdin or whatever. But
I know
what I'm saying is, why not take the movies that had a great premise and almost got it right, but still bombed, and then remake them and make them
better? Well, yeah, those are the kind of movies that need to be remade.
I would love
not
that.
Not stuff that's good that they just want to do a, you know,
yeah,
an updated version.
A good V2.
The other night I watched Urban Legend, the original from 97?
I don't know. Born.
Yeah, the original one is good. The sequels were not good.
I know.
But the original one, it's got a good cast, and you know, but that's the one they'll remake, even though it was okay in the first place, you know.
Right.
I don't know. And sometimes the remakes are okay, you know.
Sure.
I mean, I've got plenty of them that I like, you know, that maybe did it a different way, but it was cool the second time around. Dawn of the Dead's a perfect example.
Yes.
Talk about a classic horror film, and then you got a Zack Snyder version, and it's really good.
Amazing.
You know, good version. So,
ooh, we should do a season sometime, like a little bonus episode like we do, but it's like the remakes we actually like better or something.
Yeah, well, I could. Yeah, I've got some. That's for sure.
Damn.
So,
interesting. All right. Is that the last taunt?
Yep. One? That is the last one for today. So, if you do have something you want to text to us, your opinion or something or question, whatever, you can send it to the hotline. That's 217-791-7859, and we might be able to use that on the show. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, you all set to wrap this thing up?
Do it.
Okay, well, thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show. And if you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, people you meet on the street, on the bus, on the train, you know, wherever. Encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, we hope you go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. And don't forget that as an American Hauntings listener, you can use the discount code podcast for 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Because just remember, American Hauntings is more than just this podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. You can find everything about us on the website at AmericanHauntings.net.
Beautiful.
Your turn.
Oh, thanks. Okay, so
you're welcome.
Script. Okay. So this episode of the American Hauntings podcast, it was written and narrated by Troy Taylor, and produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out
about
the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. And if you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email by texting the hotline or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and a bunch of other social media spots. But we, you know, honestly, just email us, hotline, maybe Instagram.
Yeah, no one cares about Threads or Blue Sky or any of that other stuff that
exactly
came and went, I think.
Right, so. Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, so thanks.
The world is on fire. Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Thanks again for listening. we definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
We'll see you later.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.